from the Sky News Centre at 6. An extra layer of safety is being added to roller coasters at three theme parks after a crash at Alton Towers seriously injured four people. The boss of Merlin Entertainment says safety standards clearly weren't adequate on the Smiler ride when the accident happened on Tuesday. Nick Varney's told us that attraction is shut along with a similar one at Thorpe Park. Two at another theme park are also closed for now.
At Chessington, we just have two rides across our entire group, where the new heightened additional layer of safety protocols that we want to put in cannot be instantly implemented. There needs to be technical and training upgrades.
Charles Kennedy's family says alcoholism was an illness he could not conquer. They've revealed a post-mortem examination shows the former Lib Dem leader died from a major hemorrhage as a result of his drinking. Four lorry drivers have been arrested after 68 suspected illegal immigrants were found among imports arriving in the UK. They were discovered in lorries at Harwich Port, transporting washing machines from Poland. Among the stowaways from Afghanistan, China, Vietnam and Russia are two pregnant women and 15 children. Chris Wren from the Refugee Council says many people try to flee dangerous conflicts.
To put your child in a dangerous journey must be the lesser of two evils, and that it's a rational decision, because staying put if your country's in flames and your life is threatened is not an option.
A woman's been jailed for 9 years and two helpers for 4 years each for selling drugs through an online business that made millions of pounds. They had claimed the products they offered were legal highs. And Britain has been struck by lightning thousands of times today on the hottest day of the year so far. A high of 26.7 degrees Celsius was recorded in Kent. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Well, anything good I ever did.
Oh, it's D Jux. And now tuned in to BCFM 93.2 radio.
Oh. Well, anything good I ever did. Nobody ever said a thing. Never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Blatter wins, then tenders his resignation, deals behind the scenes, and the US's first goal scored to stop Russia hosting the 2018 World Cup. Well, Prime Minister's Questions was back this week, but Westminster makes rather a poor sideshow. In the wake of May's general election, it's a good idea to remind ourselves who really runs things. The real rulers of the West, the G7 and the Bilderberg, are meeting over the next week or so, geographically at the centre of NATO power. That's Germany and Austria, close to the Swiss-German border. This is where the banksters and their courtiers, the oil and media barons, give their orders to the political leaders. They, not we, have chosen to control the world's biggest economic bloc. 500 million Europeans and 250 million plus North Americans in their, not our, interest. This weekend, the leaders of the G7 countries are meeting in Schloss Elmau near Mittenwald in Bavaria, Germany. I imagine that's in the middle of the Black Forest, Mittenwald. Bavaria's not just home to the Nazi car firm BMW, financed with Nazi money made in the Second World War. It's where Adam Weishaupt's notorious Illuminati secret society, which became the governing body of European Freemasonry at the Congress of Wilhelmsbad in July 1782, is based. The next weekend, after the G7, the focus moves across the border into Austria to the Interalpen Hotel near Innsbruck and US war criminal Henry Kissinger's Bilderberg Conference. So if you wonder why politics isn't working for you, why our taxpayers' money is spent how big business want rather than how we want, you need look no further next week than a short drive from Hitler's birthplace. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first, Martin, this week, it's really quite fascinating to see that the debacle at FIFA over Sepp Blatter and the 2018-2022 World Cup, possibly they're going to happen in the countries that were originally voted on, possibly not. But what are your thoughts about the politics of this? Because I've seen almost no discussion amongst journalists here in Britain that this certainly appears to be, anyway, that politics entering the sporting arena, which, you know, is actually quite dangerous, isn't it?
Well, I think the timing of these arrests and so on is quite significant.
Well, the timing being exactly 2 days before presidential election.
Before the vote.
Now, if the police were interested in keeping out of the politics, surely they would do those arrests either after or, you know...
Indeed.
Not right 2 days before the election.
And obviously, we're all playing catch-up on this, apart from those who've been following it in detail. But the stuff I've been reading suggests that the Russians in particular have definitely... The point Putin made was, look, this is the US once again forcing its own rules on everybody else. You know, in other words, it wasn't the Swiss authorities that took steps here, it was the US authorities.
Well, the Swiss could have said no, couldn't they?
Well, the Americans can be very persuasive, let's put it that way. And for the Russians perceive this as an attempt to try and prevent them having the 2018
World Cup. And I mean, the whole point of having FIFA in Switzerland is that it's a neutral country. It's well known as a neutral
country. Indeed. And of course, what may happen, interestingly enough, is if they try and prevent Russia having the 2018 World Cup, then questions are going to be asked about how Qatar got the 2022 World Cup. And Qatar, of course, is a Western ally, deeply implicated in supporting jihadi groups inside Syria and so forth. In other words, what we're seeing in the world of football, a continuation of the kind of cold, hot war that we're seeing across the board in other institutions. Incidentally, of course, at the same time as we are, you know, looking into FIFA's supposed irregularities, the serious big banks in the US have just been given a slap on the wrist for fixing the LIBOR rate, the commodity markets, and all the rest of it. We're seeing the Sarnaev guy sent to the electric chair, probably on completely corrupt evidence in Boston.
This is the Boston Marathon.
Indeed.
I mean, what makes you say it's corrupt evidence then?
Because we've got video footage of Kraft International operatives who are like Blackwater carrying bags which are identical to the ones which actually blew up. We also know that there was a drill of a bomb going off at the marathon.
Why would the FBI etc. bother if fit up a student?
The FBI have fitted up virtually everybody who's been convicted of so-called terrorism offences in the US since 9/11 has been fitted up by the FBI. They've gone out and deliberately recruited people and say, pss, 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 do you want to be a terrorist? And when mentally ill or vulnerable people have said, oh yes, I do want to be a terrorist, then they've busted them. They've not caught one single serious person, as far as I can see. And the US justice system is frankly a joke. Martin Luther King was definitely assassinated by somebody other than the so-called lone gunman. A civil jury has already concluded that. Now, because a justice system is corrupt, that doesn't mean that you should give up on the concept of justice. But I think it's very rich for the Americans to come out chucking their weight around on the international stage about corruption when their own political system is mired in corruption. George Bush Jr. stole both presidential elections that he won, and nothing was done about it.
But I mean, Chuck Blazer, this is the one of the US delegate to FIFA, has admitted these bribes.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I'm quite sure that things about that to do with international sport, whether it's the Olympics or football, there's an awful lot of bribery goes on, and of course that's been true for years. No doubt, Britain was involved in some nefarious bribery to get the World Cup when we had it. I think the reality is that that's the real world, and of course we should look into it and try and deal with it. But first of all, arrest the bankers and the politicians who steal elections in the US, put them in prison, and of course some of them are involved in terrorism, maybe they should be executed. When we've done that, we'll deal with football.
What about the fact that we'll be talking about the Bilderberg conference in a minute. Really, ever since the Second World War, the US has tried to use its influence to keep Eastern Europe and Western Europe separate, that is to say really Russia and its sphere of influence separate from the Western European countries. The Bilderberg has been a really large part of that. And it does seem that with the FIFA scandal, there's a nervousness in the US that actually that the World Cup being held in Russia could bring the two sides together. That's not what the Americans
indeed
want.
So they're doing everything they can to make trouble between the Russian Federation and the European Union, because of course the main sanctions on Russia, of course, have basically hit the East European the European countries, East and West, who do the most trade with Russia. The Americans do hardly any trade with Russia, and that of course means that in international markets, say China or Africa, that means the Americans are going to get the deals rather than the Russians or the Europeans. The Russians and the Russians are saying to the Europeans, this is not in your interests. You're being bullied into doing this. But by and large, you've got to remember, since World War II, Western European and now Eastern European countries are effectively occupied by the United States of America. I would like to see Britain withdraw from NATO, as France withdrew from the NATO structure in 1960, and they kicked all US bases out of their country.
Well, on Facebook, Adam Johannes, who we interviewed on this programme before the NATO conference in Newport last year, he pointed out that Adolf Heutzinger, who was Hitler's chief of staff back in the early 1950s, then became NATO chief of staff.
Yes, and Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, then heads up the West German intelligence service, the BND. The NATO, from its birth, integrated large numbers of Nazi intelligence operatives into its structure. And NATO is an organisation purely designed to essentially create trouble. What is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, for example, doing marching around in the Hindu Kush, which is just about as far away from the North Atlantic as you could possibly get without going to the moon?
It's also supposed to be a defensive organization if one of the NATO countries is attacked, which they haven't been.
Well, indeed, and of course, it's not perceived that way in Russia or in China. And it's all very well for you know, people in the West to say, oh, we are defensive, we don't attack people. Tell that to Libyans, tell that to the Iraqis, tell that to the Mozambicans or Angolans, who were smashed by the South African destabilisation in the 70s and the 80s, killing millions of people with the full support of the CIA and MI6.
Yeah, what significance do you attach to the new president of FIFA that the West has been pushing, Western nations, Britain, the US, have been pushing this guy Prince Ali from Jordan, because he's a Sandhurst-trained general?
Well, indeed, and of course, as we know this week, a trial collapsed at the Old Bailey of somebody who's accused of going to Syria to be involved in terrorism, because his defence was he was going to fight for the very organisation supported by MI6 and the CIA. So in other words, with one hand we're supporting jihadis, and then with the other hand we say, oh no, you can't go and join them because we're against their policies. In actual fact, what they're trying to do, of course, is create an enemy which we can then be seen to fight. That's what's going on, and that's clearly what's going on.
I mean, is this simply, after the Ghouta chemical weapons thing failed and it was vetoed, effectively an attack on Syria was vetoed in the British Parliament a few years ago, is this whole business of ISIS, is it an attempt to topple Assad Mark II?
I think it is. And I think that Cameron, with his track record, is likely to just be an attack dog for the United States of America. Whether people in this country... I mean, General Dannett, the former head of the British Army, was saying that the British Army should go to Syria to fight ISIS. And what I feel like saying to General Dannett is that the Syrian Arab Army has taken 60,000 casualties in fighting the jihadis that they're up against. And they've still not won, but they've still not lost. Are the people in Britain prepared to take 60,000 casualties? Because if we're not, perhaps let's just stick to football.
You were talking about this terror trial that collapsed in London. There's been a bit about it in the newspapers, not a lot about it on the news, but it is a very important trial, isn't it? Swedish national Berlin Gildo is his name. His lawyers argued that British intelligence services were supporting the same Syrian opposition groups as Berlin was. They start their article with the prosecution of a Swedish national accused of terrorist activities in Syria collapsed at the Old Bailey after it became clear Britain's security and intelligence agencies would have been deeply embarrassed had a trial gone ahead.
That's right, and all the evidence is piling up.
So why can't the trial go ahead just to save their embarrassment? Surely that's not justice.
No, it isn't, but I mean, the prosecution at that point have backed off, because the defence has been robust, unlike the defence of Sarnia, for example, in the US, where his government-appointed defence attorney said, yes, he is guilty, but don't hang him, as it were. And in actual fact, the evidence shows that he's not guilty, and his family know that he's not guilty.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it, when the Crown Prosecution Service fail to prosecute people who are actually believed to be paedophiles, that is to say, right at the very top of British society, what I call VI paedophiles, the ones Westminster and Whitehall, big public figures, and yet they prosecute somebody effectively for nothing. Total waste of money.
Well, it's not effectively for nothing. I mean, well, a very interesting case in Turkey at the moment, where the local police in Turkey arrested or intercepted various lorries that were carrying weaponry through to ISIS on the other side of the border, and it turned out that those lorries were being run by their own intelligence service, the MIT. Now, the MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, work very closely with MI6 and the CIA. In other words, our people are organising, training and directing terrorism. Now, ultimately, of course, the answer to that is to arrest the generals involved, as they have done in Turkey in the past, put them on trial and then send them to prison for life. And life should mean life. The other alternative, of course, is that we're just going to go down the drain of tit for tat terrorist retaliation all round.
What do you make also of this G7 conference that's happening in Bavaria at Schloss Elmau this year? I mean, this is there's massive protests going on there. Haven't seen a lot about that coverage about that, but people from all over Europe are converging on it, largely focusing on the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership.
Well, not surprisingly, because that's being rammed down everybody's throats, even though we're not allowed to know what's in it. I find it extraordinary, as we were saying last week with our UKIP colleague, that these things can be negotiated entirely in secret. We didn't even know they were being negotiated. Even the political leadership didn't know that this would be negotiated behind the scenes. And then we're presented with a fait accompli at the end, say yes or no, and the political leadership on behalf of the people just goes, oh, I suppose so. It's totally unacceptable. And of course, this is what's happening. Corporate power is becoming overweening, absolutely overweening.
I mean, we've just had a general election. That's why I said at the top of the hour, you know, actually, there's other people seem to be really running things in the interests of big business, and the national parliament seem to have less and less power.
Well, that's right. And of course, they've also, money talk doesn't talk, it swears. The political process is incredibly skewed. If you look at the media treatment of Ed Miliband during the election campaign compared to the treatment of Cameron, the kind of things that were being said about Miliband were not being blasted out about Cameron, because people like Rupert Murdoch were determined to get Ed Miliband because he'd tried to call him to account over things like News of the World hacking and so forth.
The Conservative peer, ex-army chief, urged the Prime Minister last week to consider boots on the ground to fight ISIS. That's Sir Richard Dannett. But then in The Guardian this week, we've had Seamus Milne, an absolutely terrific article. His dad was the Director General of the BBC until he was booted out by Victor Rothschild and Margaret Thatcher in the late 1980s. And of course, the BBC's never really recovered from that. And now it's being run by HSBC, sitting in the chair of the BBC Trust. Rona Fairhead, who's in charge of the risk-taking assessment for HSBC, which clearly they decided they were going to do money laundering, and they've been fined for it, but they probably made more money at HSBC than they did were fined. So that's the chairman of the BBC. Now the vice chair is Roger Carr, who's the chairman of BAE Systems.
Well, what's happening is, step by step, a corporate takeover is taking place. And this current government, elected on 37% of the vote, is going to be absolute accomplice to all of that.
Why, though? The banksters, money laundering bank, HSBC, chairing the BBC, the biggest arms manufacturer in Europe, vice chair?
Well, I mean, the point is obvious, isn't it, Tony? Everything is being rigged. And I think you could argue that because if you added UKIP votes together with Tory votes, they would have had a slim majority, that therefore there is a mandate for this. I think plenty of UKIP voters are in fact anti the Trade and Investment Partnership, as our colleague last week was. So in other words, it's going to be rammed down our throats, whether we want it or not. Although I suspect what will ultimately happen is that all of this is going to collapse in the coming crash.
So Seamus Milne's article this week was How the Truth Now the Truth Emerges, how the US fueled the rise of ISIS in Syria and Iraq. The war on terror, he says, that campaign without end launched 14 years ago by George Bush, is tying itself up in ever more grotesque contortions. On Monday, he talks about the trial that collapsed. The Swedish man Berlin Gildo, accused of terrorism, collapsed after it became clear British intelligence had been arming the same rebel groups the defendant was charged with supporting. It also in this article talks about a whole load of revelations in the US that actually the American military were warned right at the very start of the uprising in Syria not to support the rebels, because they said that what could happen is that a force like ISIS might exist. So it's not as if they didn't know that ISIS was
I think it's worse than that. If you actually look at the detail in that report that's been leaked from the Pentagon, they knew that ISIS was going to set up an Islamic State and they wanted it to happen. They weren't hostile to it.
So why aren't they facing a trial at the Old Bailey?
Well, indeed, that's a very good question. I bet you General Dannett probably knows an awful lot more about this than he would like to talk about. But then, of course, you know, we're going to come on later in the programme, I understand, to the revelations about what's been going on in Northern Ireland for many years. The fact of the matter is that most Islamist terrorism, especially of a spectacular kind, has got links to Western intelligence services, as the Russian and Iranian general staffs well know. Now, you may say, oh, I don't want to believe that, but if the Russian and Iranian general staffs believe it, that means we're talking about World War III, unless we get our house in order.
Another report this week from Der Spiegel Online. A Bellingcat report doesn't prove anything, apparently, according to Der Spiegel. Expert criticises allegations of the Russian MH17 manipulation. Now, apparently, the Russians had been putting out pictures which supposedly proved that the MH17 plane, this is in Ukraine, the Malaysian airliner, was shot down by the Ukrainian army rather than by the rebels, and yet Bellingcat is put out a report now. Der Spiegel is now countering that. So what's the truth behind all this?
Well, I mean, obviously you've got to get into the detail, but I think the Russian general staff did in fact give a press conference where they showed their satellite time-dated.
So why is this
satellite
Bellingcat involved in any of this?
Well, what he is supposedly an independent journalist.
It's a sort of
us.
Name, isn't it? It's one of these screen names.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, but
really
in actual fact, he's basically a paid disinformation artist, and there's plenty of them about.
Okay, so what does this mean for where this investigation is happening? Because we know the two Malaysian airliners, one that disappeared in the Pacific and the other one that was shot down. The Malaysian airlines obviously have been doing really badly ever since that. Like,
well, they've
gone
bankrupt.
Pan Am, after Lockerbie, like the TWA, after the TWA flight was shot down. They go the way of all flesh, basically, when they have crashes like this. But Malaysia, as a country, has really stood up against the war on terror, hasn't it? And it's
indeed.
it's put in absentia Israeli war criminals, US war criminals, and Tony Blair, British war criminal, on trial in Malaysia. So if those people step foot in Malaysia, they'll be arrested on the spot.
Yeah, Mahathir Mohamad, who's the former president of Malaysia, has also been very clear what he thinks about the 9/11 attacks as an inside job. As various Iranian generals have spoken out, as has General Ivashov, the former head of the Russian general staff. Now you say, well, these people are all, you know, they're biased, blah, blah, blah. I would suggest to you that the head of the Russian general staff has access to a lot more information than Bellingcat, who's a paid disinformation artist for NATO.
Okay. Also, any other things you'd like to point out this week?
Well, in relation to one rather worrying development is that Poroshenko in the Ukraine has just appointed Saakashvili, who's the former president of Georgia, to run the Odessa region of Ukraine, even though he's not a Ukrainian citizen. And Saakashvili is actually wanted back in Georgia for corruption and manipulation and all the rest of it, the usual stuff. But he is famous for starting a war with Russia over South Ossetia. And the suspicion is that he's been put in place by Poroshenko for a further round of fighting in the Ukraine, and possibly to try and take the Russian-speaking region of Transnistria, which actually is on the far east of the far west of the Ukraine, between Ukraine and Moldova. In other words, that war's not over, the Syrian war's not over, and I'm quite sure that David Cameron didn't see either war that he wasn't prepared to get involved in. But I think the British people don't want to be involved in those wars, and that's where Cameron may come a cropper.
Well, one country we haven't talked about, which Britain has been involved in devastating, is Libya, and it was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. by, oh, I'm not sure who it was. Oh, Daniel Kaczynski.
Daniel Kaczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has already referred to Libya earlier on. We have exchanged views and had many debates on Libya since our military involvement in that country in 2011. And yet the situation is getting worse and worse. What new steps and initiatives is he going to bring in conjunction with allies Egypt and Italy to ensure that this situation is resolved?
I think my honourable friend is absolutely right to raise this, and there'll be some discussions at the G7 in Germany this weekend. We've got to a position where Special Representative Leon from the United Nations has been bringing everybody together to try and form a national unity government, and we need to give everything we can to support that process, because then there is some prospect of Libya having a government. From a government can then flow some security, and from security can flow the ability to start to deal with this migrant crisis in the way that I was discussing earlier.
Well, I mean, it's a bit rich coming from Cameron, isn't it? We know, through looking at the historical record, that Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was a planned war game between the French and British air forces, which was scheduled to start in March 2011 in the south of France, with the south of France to be treated as a North African country in which there was an uprising, in which there was a threat of the use of air power, and then air power would be used in order to try and help the rebels win the war. And then, glory be, the war scenario that they'd been practicing then transpired. And I think that the Western powers deliberately contrived what happened in Libya. And, of course, the Islamic Fighting Group, which has now morphed into ISIS, has a intimate track record with MI6 going back donkey's years. They were the people that tried to assassinate Gaddafi back in the 90s when Annie Machon and David Shaler, the MI5 whistleblowers, blew the gaff on that. So all of this stuff makes me really angry, actually, because we've got Western intelligence services and militaries intimately involved in fomenting Islamist terrorism, and then crying wolf and saying something's got to be done about this. Something's got to be done about them.
And there's also the refugee crisis as well.
Indeed.
And that was also brought up at Prime Minister's Questions by John Barron this time.
John Barron, the UN Secretary General, has described the refugee situation in Jordan and Lebanon as the worst humanitarian crisis of our time. What more can Britain do in tandem with other countries to help relieve the suffering and to learn from the lessons of history to ensure that poorly resourced refugee camps don't become breeding grounds for extremism?
Well, I think the first thing that we can do is to continue our investment using our aid budget as, I think, the second largest bilateral donor in terms of providing refugee support, refugee camps, whether in Jordan or elsewhere in the region. We should continue with that. But clearly, the answer to this problem is to allow those people to go back home, whether to Iraq or to Syria. So what we need is a government in both those countries that can represent and work with all of their people. Now, there's some progress in Iraq with the Abadi government, and we need to make sure they can represent Sunnis as well as Shias. In Syria, the situation is far, far worse, but we should still be continuing with the plan, with others, of training the moderate Syrian opposition and trying to bring about a transition so we get rid of the Assad regime and Assad himself, who is one of the biggest drivers of terror in the region because of what he's done to his people. That is the strategy we should pursue for however long it takes to succeed.
Well, Assad actually had a presidential election in which 50% plus participated, and he got 85% of the vote. Now, the idea that he has no support in Syria is ludicrous. As I said earlier, the Syrian Arab Army, his army, has taken 60,000 casualties fighting the jihadi rebels who have been armed, trained and directed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Britain.
But he may,
and the US.
Assad may have that support, Martin, but he's still supporting terrorism, as David Cameron says there.
Well, what is terrorism? When we're the Syrian regime is not necessarily one that I would particularly like to live under, but I wouldn't like to live in the Saudi regime either. The Western powers, people in the Middle East know that the Western powers speak with forked tongue. We've just the Saudis invaded Yemen. The British are about to place a new military base in Bahrain, where the ordinary people want the existing military base of the Americans kicked out. And the repressive regime in Egypt has just sentenced to death thousands of its political opponents, tortures everybody that gets in their way, and we support them. Now, if you support terror and tyranny, as we do, you can expect people to fight back, and they will. And of course, what the thing about the British is, they want to stick their finger into all of these troubled regions of the world in order to pursue the interests of the corporations who actually run our policy. And then we all want to go and have a nice cup of tea. The Irish Republican movement has always had contempt for the British attitude towards war and peace, and I can understand entirely why they feel like they do.
Okay, moving north a bit, 49 NATO vessels, 5,600 troops are gearing up for a major US-led drill in the Baltic. That's this weekend, and it's quite a lot of ships involved in this, Martin, isn't it? I mean, they're saying actually, though, that this is just a regular drill that happens every year.
Well, what they're trying to do is create an ongoing confrontation with Russia and China. When the world economy is on the
China
brink of a meltdown,
China isn't.
They're doing the same sort of thing in the South China Sea. Now, in other words, they are the Anglo-American Israeli axis, with the Saudis tacked onto it, is determined to prevent the Eurasian axis from developing an alternative to Western domination of the world economy. And this is this kind of change historically, where hegemony is being challenged by new and rising powers, usually leads to world wars. And that's where we're going, and Cameron's going to lead us there.
Well, actually, the NATO website is saying that this Ball Tops exercise has been held annually since 1971. This is the 43rd edition of the drill, and it's not held in any response to any specific threat.
The Russians won't see it like that, especially given everything that's happened in the Ukraine, where the sniper attack at Maidan Square was carried out, I think certainly carried out, by private sector working with Western intelligence services. The shooting down of MH17 was carried out by the Kiev Air Force with the support of NATO. The Russians are not, if you want to go around marching around saber rattling, don't be surprised if you end up with a war, because that's what happens in the end. That surely is the lesson of how World War I took place. Mindless belligerence often leads to consequences far worse than you contemplate.
And the US is also planning to return medium-range missiles to Europe. The Pentagon's considering scrapping a Cold War-era treaty and deploying nuclear-capable intermediate-range cruise missiles in Europe over Moscow's alleged treaty violations. Associated Press has reported Kremlin said it's looking closely into this report. This is on the Rush Today website.
Well, I mean, a confrontation between the West and Russia and China is definitely what they'll be discussing at the G7 at Bilderberg. That's what's going on, folks. You didn't sign up for it, but that's what you're going to get. And of course, they're going to the war, in my view, will be used as a cover for the financial collapse. They will say, "Oh, it's because of the war." You see, what happened in 1914, when the world collapsed into war, is that the stock markets all over the world collapsed, and then you moved into a much more government-controlled economy in the subsequent 4 years. And that's what's going to happen here. Capitalism will collapse under its own contradictions, and then the government will have to step in and take over things. But it won't be a socialist government, it won't be a government of the people, it'll be a military government, because we've got to deal with so-called Russian and Chinese aggression in places that most people in Britain have never heard of and care even less about.
These missiles are movable. They sort of roll around a bit like the old cruise missiles. And that puts me in mind of the V2s in the Second World War, which of course were seen as rockets that were fired from Nazi Germany over here to Britain. And of course, they were very worried towards the end of the war that one of these was going to come equipped with a nuclear bomb on it. But they were pretty much knocked out because of the static launch pads. And of course, these are actually quite dangerous, these missiles now, because they can just run around the roads and fire from wherever they want to.
Indeed, and what we should be doing, as Mikhail Gorbachev has been saying for a long time now, is what on earth are we spending money on this for? We should be building rail links between Moscow and Beijing, and then on to Berlin, and then on to London. We should be cooperating on things, matters of mutual concern. We should be building a strong, stable world economy, which allows living standards to rise, especially for the poorest. we're not doing any of those things because the dollar, petrodollar system on which the financial system of the West is based is in permanent crisis, and the only way they can keep it afloat is through war. But of course, they're running up against the fact that the Russians have never been defeated. Never.
The Russians are saying that there's a new type of missile which is entering service, S-300 and S-400. These are basically anti-ballistic missile missiles. So if a ballistic missile is heading their way, they can shoot one of these off and hopefully shoot it down. But these are just about entering service right now. It seems maybe just in time if there's any kind of exchange of these nuclear weapons.
I think the problem for NATO from a military point of view is this. If it turns into a conventional fight between the Russian army and NATO, the Russian army will win. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that. They're much better trained, they're much better organised, their equipment is better. Therefore, the temptation for NATO to go nuclear at an early stage of the game will always be there. The Russians, I think, have seen this and have actually modernised their nuclear forces so that they are in a position to second strike anyway. I mean, just think about it. You know, if you've got a nuclear submarine, a Russian nuclear submarine lurking around in the Atlantic, they can incinerate Washington if they need to.
There's also another something called the S-500 Prometheus defence systems, which are designed to take out these intercontinental ballistic missiles that actually travel through space. So it seems there's quite a lot of attention being paid in Russia to anti-ballistic missile systems.
Well, of course, because if you've got anti-ballistic missiles, that's what the ABM Treaty of 1972 was supposed to get rid of. Because once people start trying to shoot the other side's missiles down, they're then working towards the capacity for a first strike. And that's true both in China and in Russia. Now, the West has all openly pursued the capacity to make a first strike against Russia and China. Now, the Russian and Chinese leaderships, not being stupid, can see what that means. Ordinary people in the West have been bamboozled that, oh, we'll only shoot their missiles down if they shoot at us. But NATO has never said that it's never going to use nuclear weapons first. They want to put the Russians and the Chinese in a position where they can be threatened with being nuked very quickly, and that they won't be able to respond, because if they try and respond, their missiles will then be shot down. This is all Dr. Strangelove stuff, because even a minor nuclear exchange is likely to devastate human civilization. And why are we wasting time and energy on building these wretched weapons instead of trying to reduce tensions and build a better world for us all? I'm afraid it's because capitalism, in its final phases, becomes an extremely anti-human system. And ultimately, we are going to have to defeat capitalism, or capitalism is going to defeat us.
So in what role does the G8 in Bavaria play in all this?
G7.
Sorry, because the Russians were kicked out, weren't they?
Well, the G7 in Bavaria will be the Americans will be trying to whip everybody into line for the various policies they want to pursue, the trade and investment partnership, the threats against Russia, the threats against China, etc. And then the Bilderberg will be possibly where they will the real movers and shakers will get
together.
Well,
this is the interesting thing, isn't it?
Because usually they're the other way around.
Every year, the Bilderberg conference happens a little bit before the G7, just a week or so before, a couple of weeks before, somewhere in North America or Europe, in one of the NATO countries. Yeah. But this time, there's a few differences. It's happening the week after, and it's also happening in a supposedly neutral country, Austria.
Yes, well, the Austrians, in fact, are not actually... They've got a conservative government in Austria, I believe, but they're not entirely happy about this confrontational approach towards the Russians, because Austria is neutral. It's not actually part of NATO. And what's actually happened within Europe is a split, not an east-west split, but a north-south split. The northern European countries are basically more up the backside of the Americans for historical and cultural reasons. The southern European countries, whether it's Hungary or Austria or Greece or Spain or Portugal, who, don't forget, many southern European countries had NATO-backed military dictatorships in our lifetimes. They don't see the world in quite the same way as Middle England. Why should they?
What are your thoughts about the choice of Austria, though? Because I know, you've said on this show before, you've talked about this South Stream pipeline, yeah, and the fact that this is actually a bit of a clinch point between East and West, yeah, at the moment.
Well, the Austrians are quite happy to have a South Stream pipeline. It makes a lot of sense to have gas coming from Russia, which doesn't have to go through Ukraine, which is basically a shambolic mess at the best of times, and it can turn the taps off at any time just to exert pressure. But I imagine that the Americans have presumably decided to have, and the British have decided to have, these meetings where they are, so that they can put pressure on the Austrians to get into line. I would imagine that's probably what it is.
Okay. Also, Germany. I mean, we've got the G7 taking place in Germany. Revelations just a few weeks ago from The Intercept that's the site that Glenn Greenwald and others contribute to, that Rammstein in Germany, a US base in Rammstein, is actually the key hub of the world drone assassination program. And I just put it to you that the idea that you can kill someone with a Hellfire missile on a drone in Yemen, in Afghanistan or Pakistan or anywhere, you know, virtually with impunity, sitting in a little computer console somewhere in a British airbase or a US airbase or Israeli airbase, is a war crime. And these are very serious. This is a very serious really move that the West is actually advancing into really upping the arms race in an unacceptable way.
Well, they're basically going to war with humanity. And we'll see what the outcomes will be. Things are very dangerous because when people are losing power or fear losing power, they become incredibly kind of reckless. And people are basically, we're sleepwalking towards disaster here, both economically and politically.
But we're not just sleepwalking, are we? We're being sort of nudged along.
Well, that's right. You are feeling sleepy, sleepy. When I snap my fingers, we will go to war with Russia.
US, EU and Russian political power does pivot around that part of Europe. I mean, I'm looking specifically, I suppose, at the just across the border in Switzerland, in Basel, from where all this is taking place. You've got it in southern Germany, in Austria, and then just across the border in Switzerland as well is the Bank for International Settlements. Now, we've had this Swiss role in the FIFA scandal, which is the Swiss police doing these arrests. Well, actually, the United States was very, very close to the Swiss, and the Nazis were in the Second World War, and particularly at the end, because we know that the Bank for International Settlements, which the Bretton Woods Conference attempted to close down, was providing a lot of the finance for the Nazi Party and for Hitler's war machine. And also, they said that they wanted to close this BIS down, but they didn't. It's now actually at the centre of a lot of world banking regulation, and Mark Carney was the chair of the regulation committee at the BIS in Switzerland. I mean, we sold this kind of myth that the present governor of the Bank of England was from Canada, from the Bank of Canada. Actually, he was a key person at the BIS. So just tell us a bit about the BIS in Switzerland and how powerful it is controlling the Western banking system, which, of course, has been, over the last few years, since 2008, caused a total disaster, and with impunity, with no prosecutions.
Well, it's very opaque what goes on at that level. Let's put it that way. Montagu Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, famously used the BIS to remove the Czech Republic's gold supply to the Germans after they'd invaded. They got their gold supply in the BIS. And Montagu Norman, in 1939, when Germany invaded Czechoslovakia, insisted that the BIS supply the Nazi regime that had taken over in Czechoslovakia with the Czech gold, because otherwise business would be undermined. And the view of Montagu Norman, the head of the Bank of England, was that wars come and go, but business goes on forever. And I think that just about sums up the role of the banking system in the geopolitical crisis that we're in. They want war because it preserves their power and their assets. Many of them are definitely criminals. I mean, that's one thing that did come out of these trials of the bankers in the US and elsewhere in the last few weeks. They are definitely criminals. They pleaded guilty. They should have been sent to prison and their assets should have been seized. And of course, if they start doing things like that, then deficits start to become much more manageable.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour this group, the Illuminati, also based in Bavaria, and they did have a famous conference in 1782, I mean, we're going back a long, long way here, in Wilhelmsbad, where these various different branches of Freemasonry right across Europe, including, for example, Grand Orient in France, which was an atheist version of Freemasonry, in Britain, the York Rite and other branches were supposedly, anyway, Christian versions of Freemasonry. But this event in 1782 brought all of these under the governing body called the Illuminati, based in Bavaria. One of the things I was just digging into this, and actually when the Bavarian government very first discovered that this organisation, this secret society, was meeting, they managed to get some leaks of the plans that they had to take over the government of Bavaria and of Germany, and also to take over the German religious bodies. They arrested people. Some of them went to jail, but most of them basically just got lost their jobs and that kind of thing. I was quite fascinated to discover that it was Ernst II, the Duke of Saxe-Gotha, in Bavaria, who actually sheltered Weishaupt, the founder of this movement. And of course, his ancestors are the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family that are now the British royal family. So it seems that there is a sort of, families that have been elitist families for centuries, Martin.
I think there's no doubt about it that the elite tends to self-perpetuate in any society. That's a truism. I don't know how helpful it is to go as far back as that, because it then leaves people saying, well, you can't really suggest. Nobody that was alive in 1782 is alive today. The time horizon which I think is more relevant is the lifetime, our lifetimes, and recent.
I think
history.
The point I'm trying to make, rather than is that actually these families are very, very concentrated. Their minds are very concentrated on holding on to their wealth, and they see a lot of the left, and particularly communism, as a threat to that, taking their wealth off them. They would much rather spend their life playing golf than have to go to work for a living.
Well, indeed. Indeed. And, families like the Rothschilds clearly have been at the centre of banking power for centuries.
They themselves would admit so.
I
mean, there's two things we've been talking about tonight, which the Rothschilds most definitely were involved in. One is the sacking of Alistair Milne, who was Seamus Milne's father, who was Director General of the BBC, Victor Rothschild, back in 1987. And then there's also the their attendance and involvement in the Bilderberg conferences. So you've got this kind of European banking network of the Rothschilds. In the United States, you've got the Rockefellers, who were originally an oil company, oil family, and then they realised actually banking seems to be a lot more lucrative.
Well, what tends to happen in elite politics is, if you can't beat them, join them. So you get conflict between different elite groups, but ultimately they tend to club together to protect their collective privileges from the rest of society. And it's what Robert Michel's used to call the iron law of oligarchy a long time ago. And as a 19th century social scientist. People shouldn't be surprised about this. The world has always been run by the powerful. It still is.
It seems like almost a sort of capitalist version of the feudal system, where it's not about whether you're a king, a prince, a princess, a duke, a marquis, or a marchioness, or whatever. It's all about how much money you've got in the bank and how much power you've got and what boards you're on.
Well, what tends to happen is various forms of elite power become fused. So the obvious thing that bankers and industrialists did in 19th century Britain is they married aristocrats, and then the children are both bankers, industrialists, and aristocrats.
Okay, what about this? The significance, though, of the Bilderberg being after the G7? I mean, I certainly look at that and I think, well, actually, most of the time the Bilderberg is having a discussion and it's kind of tweaking tweaking policy, seeing which of the elites around Europe and North America, which policies they're going to go for and which not. Although I think there's also a large aspect of the Bilderberg Conference, which is bringing in people who are on the fringes of power to sort of schmooze them. Also, of course, looking at up-and-coming new politicians. I'm not sure if it's Harriet Harman's going to be there, but, people who are
up-and-coming,
powerful, who are in a position maybe to take over or to succeed someone else in a large, powerful opposition party. But the idea that Bilderberg Conference is taking place after G7, for some reason, I look at this and I think, well, actually, maybe the final plans for what's going to happen in the next year or so in regards to a lot of NATO's foreign policy, military policy, possibly economic technology policy, is actually going to be made at Bilderberg rather than G7.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what the significance is. I think it is significant that Bilderberg normally is the place where they coordinate before they end up at the G7, which is a more public event. So the way they're doing it the other way around this time, it's very suspicious.
Well,
it could well be.
We know Westminster's a sideshow. It looks like even the G7 is becoming
a
sideshow.
Well, indeed. And so what may be happening is that they are preparing a full-on confrontation with Russia, for the end of the year, as the markets collapse, because they may well do in the next week or so when the Greeks don't pay their debts.
Okay, well, how does this actually fit then with the economic situation? I mean, we've got all these sort of potential crises on the horizon. We've had them for many years, but in a way you get kind of crisis fatigue, don't you?
Yes.
But they're certainly
still there.
So you've got an economic crisis, you've got the climate crisis. Let's just set that aside for a moment. But looking at the economic crisis and the crisis with Ukraine, the potential war there,
Syria. Don't forget Syria.
And Syria, which I think those are both definitely related, because it's about the Russian Black Sea Fleet and their access to the Mediterranean. Mm. A lot of what's been going on in Crimea, anyway. So, I mean, what are your thoughts about the timing of those two possible crises? And maybe that's the sort of thing that the people like the Bilderbergs are talking about.
I think that is exactly what they're talking about. They are trying to get all their ducks in a row to carry out the political démarche that they want to carry out, which is essentially to use war to cover up their failures in global economic policy.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, last week, the BBC transmitted on BBC One Panorama one of the best documentaries I've seen they've done for at least a decade, and it was really looking at some of the crimes that have been going on in Northern Ireland, but particularly through the British Army's presence in Northern Ireland. Now, Martin, this is immensely significant, really, that the BBC are taking these kinds of issues on, isn't it?
It is, and, you know, we've had discussions on this programme about whether investigative journalism is dead, and some contributors suggesting that it's not entirely dead, and I think that this programme leads one to believe that it is not entirely dead. And I salute the BBC for pursuing this topic. It has been pursued in the past by John Ware, who's, I think, less comprehensive in his coverage than Donal
McIntyre. I think he's also a BBC journalist in BBC Northern Ireland who's seen, I mean,
he's a local.
Yeah, I mean, he's a local chap, and also he's been pulling together a lot of threads of this over the years. For example, the killing of the journalist from the Sunday World Catholic newspaper, Martin O'Hagan, as well. I mean, that is something which is just one of the most horrendous stories you'll ever hear about. I mean, the family knows who killed him, the police know who killed him, and yet nothing's been
after the Troubles had officially
That's
ended.
Right. After the end of the Troubles, and yet still no justice. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip from that documentary. It's called Britain's Secret Terror Deals, and really we're discussing British Army employing serial killers to murder Catholics, often completely at random, and also to kill Protestants.
The men were stopped at King's Mills while travelling home from work.
They came up to this series of bends. And the road was climbing ahead of them. And as they just got up here to the brow of the hill, they were waved down by what they took to be an army patrol. Just here. And that was the beginning of the nightmare for Alan Black and the community of Bessbrook.
He told us all to put our hands up on top of the minibus. And the next thing he said, right. Noise of the gunfire, I'll never ever forget it. The noise was deafening, and what they'd done, they'd shot us all at waist high to stop anyone running properly, and it went on for I don't know how long. There's only one man ever spoke, and he said, finish them off. Started to go around shooting to finish himself. So I lay as quietly as I could. And there was a bullet hit me in the head, but it didn't penetrate my skull. It grazed me.
Alan Black suffered 18 gunshot wounds. He was the only survivor.
I knew the boys were dead because there was absolutely no sound.
No one has been convicted of the murders. Relatives feel the case has never been properly investigated.
There was a wall of silence for a long, long time. I used to sort of ask Mum quite often, "Have you heard anything, Mum? Has anybody came and spoken to you?" And the answer was always the same. And then I just stopped asking Mum because I knew in my heart that for some reason, and I don't know what that reason is as yet, but there was never going to be any proper information or any investigation.
The Protestant community traditionally trusted the state as its protector. But for people like Alan Black, that trust has been replaced by suspicion. He's been told crucial evidence, including his own witness statement, has been lost.
You think they're hiding something?
They're definitely hiding something. The first thing they'd done, they said that they had a fire and files were lost. Then they had a flood and files were lost. Then they had an explosion at the barracks and files were lost. Then they had asbestos contamination and files were lost. Why are they doing this on us? Why are they withholding all this? What are they so afraid? Why are they afraid of the truth? What is it that they're hiding?
Panorama knows the identities of some of those believed to have been involved in the murders. And it is clear that within weeks of the attack, police knew their names too.
Do you know who was responsible?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know their names?
Yes, so do the police.
Well, it was pretty shocking stuff, actually, Martin. And, you know, the idea that the authorities know, the relatives know who's carrying out these murders, but nothing's being done about it still. I mean, there is obviously the peace settlement, which hopefully will mean that there might be a moratorium on prosecutions in order to kind of solidify that. But it's still very significant because it looks as if hundreds of people here were murdered by people who are being protected by the state, by the British state.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you watch the whole programme, and it's well worth trying to get a hold of a copy of it on Catch-Up or whatever, you will see that Nuala O'Loan, who's the police ombudswoman in that, says, well, hundreds of people were killed by agents of the British Army. Now, in other words, the general perception of the conflict on this side of the water is that the IRA were blowing things up and then they were persuaded to give it up, and thank goodness for that, because the British Army was trying to keep the peace. Patently rubbish. The British Army ran the Loyalist Terror Campaign, which killed hundreds of people.
Now, right,
that was all orchestrated from inside the Force Research Unit run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr.
Right now in Northern Ireland, there's a bit of a standoff because the Sinn Féin in the Stormont Parliament are resisting any implementation of benefit cuts. So let's just hear that was discussed at Prime Minister's Question this week.
Nigel Dodds!
In the gracious speech by Her Majesty last week, the government committed to legislating to implement the Stormont House Agreement, and as he knows, that agreement has our full support in the DUP. It is an agreement that was signed up to by all the five main parties in Northern Ireland and the British and Irish governments. Now that it has been reneged on, certainly the welfare reform aspect by Sinn Féin, now that vulnerable people are being hurt, public services hit as a result of £2 million a week fines being implemented and a black hole in the Northern Ireland budget, does he agree with his Secretary of State, following the talks yesterday, that all the parties who signed up to that agreement, SDLP and Sinn Féin included, should now implement it? And if they fail to do so, will he take steps to preserve the integrity of that agreement?
Well, first of all, let me agree with the right honourable gentleman that everyone who was party to those talks, and they were exhaustive and lengthy talks ending in an agreement, everyone should implement that agreement in full.
That's from Prime Minister's Questions. Martin, it's a bit of a standoff, isn't it?
It is, but I think Sinn Féin are right to resist benefit cuts, and that's what they will benefit politically from it.
Okay, time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects, here on BCFM on Tuesdays at noon, where you can hear much more about the forthcoming Bilderberg Conference, where real decisions in Europe and America are made. Our show site is at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time, this show, at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. The head of some of the UK's biggest theme parks says more roller coasters are being closed as he puts extra safety measures in place. The Smiler ride's been shut at Alton Towers for the foreseeable future after four people were seriously injured on it on Tuesday. Another attraction at Thorpe Park is out of action long term, while two at Chessington will be closed for a few days. Relatives of Charles Kennedy say alcoholism was an illness he couldn't conquer. The results of a post-mortem examination show the former Lib Dem leader died from a major hemorrhage as a result of his drinking. Former Downing Street communications chief Alistair Campbell says his friend did go for long periods without drinking, but the tragedy is he never managed to give up.